Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Now here's something you don't hear about every day. A government program that costs less than anybody thought it would. We learned today taxpayers are only going to lose about $40 billion on the bank bailout. So now the White House is looking for places to spend the rest. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bank of America, which has begun a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low to moderate income communities. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 7th of December. Good to have you with us. The TARP, the bank bailout, was budgeted last fall at $700 billion. A couple of months ago, best guesses were taxpayers would lose about $240 billion on the deal. Well, this coming Wednesday morning, we are going to get a report from the Government Accountability Office that says, in fact, we are only going to lose about $40 billion. Do a little government accounting of your own. That means the White House just found $200 billion to spend. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Banks that got loans from the federal government are paying them back faster than expected. At a speech this afternoon, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke was asked whether he thinks taxpayers will get their bailout money back.
Yes, I do. I think we're in very good shape. In fact, I do believe we're going to get back all the money. And indeed, we are going to be showing for the taxpayer a fairly significant extra income.
$200 billion could make a hefty dent in the $1.5 trillion projected deficit this year, but House Democrats have their eye on some of that money to pay for another stimulus bill. Is that a good use of the money? Deficit hawks like Maya McGinnis at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget think not.
The problem in Washington is that any time something comes in better than expected or a new money source opens up, it gets spent three ways instead of doing what we should be doing with it, which is repaying those funds.
But Democratic leaders like Maryland Congressman Chris Van Hollen say right now there are higher priorities than cutting the deficit.
These are dollars that have been in part now repaid from Wall Street because the financial sector is recovering. And we think it's important that some of that money now be redirected to Main Street, where people are hurting and there are a lot of people out of work.
Democrats are proposing to divert about half the $200 billion windfall into infrastructure projects, tax breaks, and more unemployment benefits. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
With all this talk of redirecting the bank bailout, let's not forget hundreds of banks out there aren't quite ready to pay anything back. Citigroup, for one, springs to mind. Also, dozens of regional banks that support small businesses and community development. They have accepted billions of dollars in taxpayer money. And Marketplace's Amy Scott reports they say there are good reasons to hold on to it.
The first reason is that regional banks lend a lot more of their money to fund projects like malls and condo developments. Defaults on those loans are at a 16-year high and rising. Matthew Anderson with Foresight Analytics says as many as 250 more banks could fail in the next year. Until those losses start to recede, he says regional banks won't be paying anyone back.
And I think that'll be next year at the earliest, if not more like 2011.
Reason number two, analyst Craig Siegenthaler at Credit Suisse says to pay the money back, banks have to raise so-called common equity by selling shares, and that hurts current shareholders. If they wait, he says they can earn that money organically.
So I think a lot of these banks are thinking, you know, we're going to pay it back, but why don't we wait a few years out and try to pay it back with a lower level of common equity? From a shareholder perspective, that's the most favorable scenario.
The third factor, even if banks are ready to repay the government, the Treasury Department might not let them. Scott Valentin is with FBR Capital Markets. He says Treasury wants to make sure banks have enough of a cash cushion to absorb future losses.
The last thing the Treasury would want to see would be them to approve a bank repaying TARP And then maybe in 12 months or 18 months, that bank runs into problems again from a capital perspective.
Valentin says a lot is riding on how fast the economy improves. If Friday's better-than-expected employment figures aren't just a blip and the economy really is coming back, he says banks will repay the money sooner. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The climate change spotlight for the next couple of weeks is going to be firmly on Copenhagen, Denmark. And when President Obama shows up at the big UN meeting in about 10 days or so, he is not going to have an American domestic climate change bill to brag about. But today, the Environmental Protection Agency gave him something he can at least point to, a formal finding that global warming gases endanger human health. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports.
Today, I'm proud to announce that EPA has finalized its endangerment finding on greenhouse gas pollution and is now authorized and obligated to make reasonable efforts to reduce greenhouse pollutants under the Clean Air Act.
That's EPA Chief Lisa Jackson. Her message is simple. If Congress isn't going to pass legislation to control global warming, her agency will regulate. That means limiting emissions from heat-trapping gases like carbon dioxide, but also methane, nitrous oxide, and a few trace gases you didn't learn in Chem 101, like sulfur hexafluoride.
Some of them have heat-trapping capacity that are thousands of times more than carbon dioxide.
Brenda Eckwurzel at the Union of Concerned Scientists says greenhouse gases come from dozens of sources, power plants, steel mills, trucks, refrigerators, even cow poop. But David Bookbinder, chief climate counsel for the Sierra Club, says the EPA will target only the biggest polluters. He expects the first thing the EPA will do is tighten tailpipe standards for automobiles. Later, he says, the agency may even require coal-fired power plants to switch to a more climate-friendly fossil fuel.
Will EPA talk about natural gas as a control technology for CO2? And that is a very big question that EPA is wrestling with right now.
Of course, we may not get the answer anytime soon. Already, some opponents of regulations say they'll file suit to stop the EPA. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
It was slow and steady on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Maybe you noticed this when the economy was still on the way down. The grocery stores and pharmacies really started pushing their own lower-cost store brands. A better deal, they said, than those fancy-schmancy brand names. Manufacturers went into overdrive producing them. Consumers did start buying them in bunches. And Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains that has created a bit of a problem for the big household goods companies. As the economy recovers, they need a way to get their business back.
If you've been in a drugstore or a supermarket lately, you've probably noticed there's store brands for almost everything. Paper towels, baby formula, laundry detergent. Leon Nicholas is in charge of retail insight at MVI. It's a consulting firm. He says stores have been working really hard to make those house brands just like your favorite name brands, but cheaper.
And so they're working with various suppliers of these products in order to get them to enhance the store brand.
Consumers have noticed. Over the last year or so, private label brands have been getting a much bigger share of the market, which is why the big names, places like Procter & Gamble and Kimberly-Clark, are all getting ready to introduce a slew of new products. They're trying to get shoppers to come back to Tide and Bounty and Crest. John Long watches the retail business at Kurt Salmon Associates, a retail consulting firm. He says big companies need to convince consumers their name brand products offer a real premium.
They have to provide some type of benefit back to the customer in order to warrant the additional spend, because customers are still being very careful with how they're allocating their funds.
And that doesn't just mean a new package or a new scent. Both Nicholas and Long say there'll have to be some real innovations if customers are going to come back to the name brands. Procter & Gamble's working on a new thinner diaper, and Schick is getting ready to introduce yet another high-tech razor. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
If ever there was a month that was tough on impulse control, this is it. Got your holiday parties with all those tasty drinks and rich desserts. There are the expensive gifts you'd like to buy for family and friends, and holiday sales pretty much all over where you can buy yourself something nice. In short, everything about December says act without thinking, spend without worrying, consume with wild abandon. So just to spoil the party, we've got Dan Ariely, our favorite behavioral economist, here with us to talk impulse control. Dan, good to have you back.
Same here.
I will say right off the bat, I, as it happens, have great impulse control. Lots of willpower.
Really?
Yeah.
Give me an example.
Do. Okay, here we go. 2.5 years ago, I weighed 196 pounds.
2.5 years ago?
Oh, no. Okay, it's an evolving story. I weighed 196 pounds. I now weigh 174, and I'm very proud of that. I maintain it, and I control my impulse to eat chocolate cake and all that good stuff.
That's very good. How about while you drive? Are you tempted to check your phone or text messages?
Nope.
So you're saying food doesn't do it for you?
Yeah.
You're doing well on driving?
Yeah. Come on,
maybe
take your
you're
best
one
shot.
Of those.
What else do you have?
No, it's very good. I mean, I'm impressed.
Well, thank you. But how does this spill over then into broader behavior?
So it turns out, first of all, that controlling things is very hard. You know, we have problems with procrastination where, you know, today it's much better to do things that are fun than to do work. When we do the trade-off between the here and now and later, often we succumb to the here and now. And you seem like you're an exceptional human being in many aspects, including this one. But for most people, this is tough. But here's an interesting thing. Roy Baumeister and some of his colleagues have shown that what happened is that as we try to resist, it becomes harder and harder for us to resist temptation. So imagine, for example, that you're walking in and you see some kind of wonderful chocolate cake. Mm-hmm. And you say, oh, you know, I'm not going to get it. And then you go ahead and you see some other fried stuff. And you say, oh, I'm not going to get this. And you resist temptation and you resist temptation and you resist temptation. As it turns out, the more you resist temptation, the harder it is for you to resist temptation until at some point you fail and get the fatty, unhealthy stuff. And in fact, all the decisions don't have to be the same way. So, for example, if you are seeing a funny movie, and you can think whatever makes you laugh, and you get instructions, don't laugh. And you try very, very hard to hold yourself from not laughing. You're using all your self-control ability to basically make sure that you're not going to laugh. And then I say, what do you want, chocolate cake or an apple? Now you're much more likely to go for the chocolate cake.
Well, take it out of the movie theater for a minute and away from chocolate cake. And how does it apply more broadly?
So, you know, we've done lots of experiments on cheating when we tempt people to cheat, to steal money from us, and we see how much money they steal. And we were wondering whether if we deplete people, if we get them to exercise this self-control and kind of weaken their ability to resist temptation, are they going to cheat more? And that's what actually we found. So we gave people all kinds of tasks that depleted their self-control, and then we gave them a task in which they could cheat. And what happened was that these people cheated much more.
What happens, though, if you do get depleted? How do you replenish that self-control? Can you build it back up again?
So you want the really sad story?
I guess so.
So there are some findings by Rob Baumeister and his colleague that says that if you exercise self-control, you can increase it a little bit over time. But the really sad thing is that to really build up your self-control outside of, you know, sleeping for the night and so on, it's to consume sugar. So, for example, if you drink sweet tea with actual sugar rather than one of those artificial replacements, you all of a sudden rebuild your self-control.
Go figure. Dan Ariely from Duke University. He teaches behavioral economics there. His book is called Predictably Irrational. Dan, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Coming up, Japan's early lessons in energy conservation.
Everybody was aware that we have to do something, otherwise our life itself won't be sustainable.
But first, let's do the numbers. Ben Bernanke's speech today about staying the economic course had the markets staying the economic course. The Dow Industrial's basically flat, gained a point, closed at 10,390. The NASDAQ shed 4 points, 0.2%, finished at 2189. The S&P 500 gave back 2 points, 0.25%, ended the day at 1103. Managed healthcare providers got a spoonful of sugar today, that after Goldman Sachs said a healthcare overhaul won't affect bottom lines as much as projected. Aetna and Cigna both shot up 3%. Humana rose 0.75% today. Telecom companies held the line. Verizon Communications jumped 1.75%. AT&T rang up a 0.75% gain. Consumer products took a hit, though. Colgate-Palmolive brushed away 2.6% today. Avon scrubbed off 3.6%. Kimberly-Clark down 1%. Procter & Gamble lost 0.2%. The weight loss company Nutrisystem packed on 8.5% after announcing its prepared meals will be sold at Sam's Club. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. By Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by Bank of America, 1 year into a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low to moderate income communities. Throughout the trading day, we're talking business and the economy on our blog, The Scratchpad. Check in with online host Scott Jagow and join the discussion at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Tuesday. President Obama talks about putting Americans back to work in a speech on the economy. A House Subcommittee on Health holds a hearing on the cost of brand-name prescription drugs. Are prices rising too fast? And on December 8th, 1980, rock star John Lennon was shot to death in front of his Manhattan residence. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Should you happen to have a spare $200,000 on you, Richard Branson has just the thing for you. The British billionaire unveiled the centerpiece of his latest venture at an airfield in the Mojave Desert up north of Los Angeles today. Spaceship Two will rocket wealthy tourists into space, thousands of tourists, Branson says, within the next couple of years. Branson claims that so far Virgin Galactic has already booked around 700 passengers at the aforementioned $200,000 a pop. We asked our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, how close the space tourism business really is to taking off.
Almost half a century ago, an airline that's long since gone out of business started taking reservations for trips to the moon.
On Pan Am, the sky is no longer the limit.
Wannabe astronauts never gave up hope, and some who grew up and made lots of money have paid a total of $42 million just to book a mere 5 minutes in weightless bliss on the fringe of space. John Logsdon is a space policy expert at George Washington University.
It's a far way away from generating enough revenue to pay the cost of Mr. Branson's enterprise. And so my question is, how many more beyond the 700 are willing to pay six-figure amounts for this experience?
The promotional videos on Virgin Galactic's website make it sound exciting.
The captain has now turned off the fastened seatbelt sign. You are now free to float around the cabin as you wish.
But how much would you be willing or able to pay for not even a full orbit, just a quick view of the curvature of the Earth?
I think prices will have to come down. The current price figure, I think, will quickly exhaust the available market of people with that kind of discretionary money.
Professor Logsdon says economies of scale could eventually bring prices down a little, but aerospace analyst John Pike is skeptical, given the odds of trouble flying the number of people necessary to make a profit. And he points out this fast up and down barely qualifies as space travel.
The next step, actually going orbital, well, a ticket for that is going to be about 100 times more expensive because it's at least 100 times more difficult and probably significantly more dangerous.
So for most of us, the sky will still be the limit. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
This isn't quite rocket science, but there is news from the junction of music and digital technology today. Apple announced it's buying a company called Lala.com. Lala is a music content provider. It's been around for about 4 years, and it can do some things that Apple and iTunes can't. Erica Ogg covers Apple for CNET.com. Eric, good to have you with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
For the uninitiated amongst us, which I have to say until about 8 o'clock this morning included me, what is Lala?
Lala.com is a service where people can listen to music over the web as opposed to buying music and then downloading it to their computer.
So it's streaming music, right?
Exactly. Streaming okay. music.
What makes this attractive to Apple then?
Well, you know, we don't know. They haven't explained their plans to us. But there's a number of situations here. A lot of companies are turning toward streaming music over the web versus the download model, which is what Apple's iTunes is. Mm-hmm. And there's been sort of a rash of these companies getting picked up by competitors to iTunes. There's companies like iLike and iMeme, which were picked up by MySpace earlier, which also has a big music effort. So, you know, this could be Apple maybe staking some room out for the future in case they want to do this, or they could have specific plans in mind.
Could those plans include, you know, other things like social connection and social media aspects to it? I mean, what else does Lala do that Apple doesn't right now with iTunes?
I think more people are getting used to the idea of streaming their music over the web. Basically, that means you don't have to own the music files. And so if you don't have to host the music on your own computer, it's going to be a lot more attractive to people that maybe don't have their iPod with them or they don't have their home laptop with them, you know, where the music is that they own. So they want to be able to listen to music anywhere.
For all we don't know about Apple, and they are a secretive bunch, what do we know about what they're doing?
Well, we do know that they are building this huge data center in North Carolina. This, you know, I think the price is somewhere at $1 billion. So looking at this Lala acquisition and looking at this server farm that they have, there is the idea that they could be planning to use that to store music, what's otherwise known as putting stuff in the cloud, then letting people access their music via the web. We don't know that that's what they're doing, but I mean, when you put the two and two together, it seems like it could be possible.
Play this out for me then about how it might change the way we listen to music. I mean, obviously, Apple and iTunes have done a huge amount of that work already, changing, you know, how it's distributed and how we enjoy it. What might this do in the next, you know, 3 to 5 years?
Well, I think it comes down to the idea of whether you own music or not. You know, Apple's gotten us used to the idea of paying for something. We buy a song and we put it on our computer and then maybe transfer it to an MP3 player. By streaming, you don't necessarily own it, and it's more like a subscription service. So there's been a lot of talk about Apple's entire iTunes store proposition about whether they're thinking of doing the same thing for where a subscription service for TV shows. They could also offer the same thing for music.
Yeah, does that ring true for you, this idea of not owning this thing that you enjoy somehow?
I think we're getting used to it, especially with ideas like Hulu or Netflix, where you can pay for access and you can, you know, just watch movies whenever you want, but you don't necessarily own them like a DVD. I think people are getting more used to that idea.
Erica Ogg at CNET. Erica, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Much of the discussion in Copenhagen is going to be about rich countries versus poor, developed economies versus those that are still developing. Who's going to cut their emissions by how much, and just plain how? How are they going to do it? Japan offers some pretty good lessons from KQED. Rob Schmitz reports.
Meet the Sakaki family, dad Hiroshi, mom Yukiko, and 3-year-old daughter Mei. The Sakakis have a heater in their home, but they prefer to wear sweaters. Their power strips have individual on-off switches, so their appliances won't waste energy. They only buy energy-efficient lights. Each night, they share bath water. Their bathtub talks to them. It warns them when they're wasting energy. The Sakakis aren't rabid environmentalists. They're just an average Japanese family living in Tokyo, and they do whatever it takes to save energy. Energy costs twice as much here as in the U.S. That's because Japan imports nearly all its fossil fuels. The lessons most Americans are starting to learn from rising oil prices are ones the Japanese learned 3 decades ago after the steep oil price hikes of the 1970s. Economist Yukari Yamashita recalls the oil price surge had Japan's economy on the brink of collapse.
The prices of everything went up because of the oil crisis. So everybody was aware that we have to do something. Otherwise, our life itself won't be sustainable.
Yamashita says it was as if the country were at war. The government held emergency meetings, quickly passing a series of conservation laws. It forced factories to replace old, inefficient boilers and assembly line machinery with new energy-saving equipment. New energy taxes funded programs like low-interest loans for companies that made industry more energy efficient. As a result, Japan, the world's second largest economy, now consumes one-half the energy per capita of the United States. At a factory near the city of Kyoto, singing robots carry parts from one assembly line to another. Nowhere have these energy-saving measures had more impact than on Japan's industrial sector, where current energy use is on par with levels 40 years ago. This, despite dramatic economic growth since then. Air conditioner maker Daikin owns this plant. Under Japanese law, manufacturers have to become 1% more energy efficient every year and dedicate at least one staff member to overseeing this effort. Daikin has 8. Also, manufacturers have to make sure that any new appliance they put on the market is at least as efficient as the best current model. Back in his office, manager Shinya Okada says he disliked the law when it was passed 12 years ago.
But now we find it valuable to compete with one another and develop technology, not only to meet the strict government standards, but to cater to the needs of our customers.
And that makes Japanese companies more competitive, says Llewellyn Hughes, Japan expert at George Washington University. He remembers when it was fashionable to say America innovates, Japan imitates.
Perhaps an opportunity exists to go the other way. That is to learn from Japan, learn the lessons which have already been learned within Japanese national economy about how better to promote energy efficiency and also improve competitiveness in this particular sphere of the economy.
Japan's got a head start. A recent global survey showed Japan owns 40% of the world's patents in green technology. The U.S. came in second with just 12%. In Tokyo, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. By Meritas, a worldwide alliance of law firms helping business owners and in-house counsel find pre-qualified local legal counsel for over 19 years. Meritas.org. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, as we've mentioned, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke gave a speech to the Economic Club of Washington this afternoon, half an hour or so of standard Fed speak. And then he took some questions from the audience, including this one.
What is the best thing about being chairman of the Federal Reserve Board?
I get to go through the security lines at the airport much more quickly than, and I can take along even 3 ounces of fluid if I want to.
Just a regular guy, right? You're on the global economy, just a regular guy. That's Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow gained a point. That's basically flat. The Nasdaq, rather, lost 4 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 dropped 2 points. That's 0.25%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, and Megan Larson, and also Fiona Ng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this broadcast, rising unemployment and falling child support.
We've had some plant closings around Nashville. These folks have no control over that. You know, for the most part, they're going out looking for jobs, acting in good faith.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.